happens to a person after they're arrested? Are they released to the community, or do they remain in jail because they can't make bail? What systems are in place to maintain public safety? That process is changing because of Alaska's new criminal justice reform laws. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss the state's new pretrial services and how they affect the criminal justice system.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Today on the program, we're talking about pre-trial services and the system for monitoring people who have been charged with a crime but not yet sent to trial. My guests are Jerry Fox, the head of the pretrial division of the Department of Corrections, and Nancy Mead, the general counsel to the Alaska court system. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, our listeners. What questions do you have about the new pretrial system? Do you think it could impact crime? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-8255 statewide or 550-8422 here in Anchorage. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So today we're talking pretrial services, which sounds pretty jargony. Jerry, what exactly is that?
That's probably the fundamental question that I think most Alaskans have. So first, let me thank you for hosting this show so that we have an opportunity to help Alaskans understand what exactly has just happened in our state. Pretrial functions look differently around the United States depending upon the needs of the state and the resources of a state. So most pretrial agencies actually belong to counties, but in our system, it belongs to the state, which is in this case under the Department of Corrections. So we have primarily two main responsibilities. One is providing assessment to the court, and the assessment measures two things: the likelihood that a defendant will fail to appear for court if they are released, and the second is the likelihood of a new criminal arrest if a defendant is released. It is not a dangerousness measurement, but it does help the court make decisions about what release could look like and what kinds of conditions should be in place.
Okay, so I'm going to pause you just right there. Mm-hmm. So basically, a person is arrested, and before pretrial services, before this new system was created and put in place, after a person was arrested, what was the next step?
The next step would be to go to an arraignment hearing with a judicial representative there. And that included usually a prosecutor, and it may have included a defense attorney. So now we're seeing more defense counsel in the courtroom. That's been one of the immediate changes we're seeing.
Okay.
Because there's now a new risk assessment tool that helps the judiciary have a little bit better sense of the statistical likelihood of success or failure of that individual. Other things still matter, like they always have. A judge can still consider certain mm-hmm. components of what a defendant has done or the likelihood of a future risk.
Wait, before we get into all those details, so before the system is, you get arrested,
yep.
You go to jail, you have an arraignment. Mm-hmm. Is this right, Nancy?
Yes, yeah. Basically.
Okay.
Usually.
And then after the arraignment, then what?
At the arraignment, the judge determines whether there was probable cause for the arrest, and if so, sets an appropriate bail, and that can be a release decision as well as conditions if the person would be released. Mm-hmm. So the judge has options under the former statute, and still does, mm-hmm. but in the past, if that's what we're talking about, mm-hmm. the judge considered all the factors that they might have in front of them. The prosecutor typically would present, for example, the defendant's criminal history, and other factors that perhaps the prosecutor thought would indicate that the person would do better if they were held on a monetary bail. And the judge would consider whether that was appropriate and sometimes impose a monetary bail, sometimes impose a third-party custodian, which would be an individual in the community that the court could appoint to watch the individual, basically 24/7, and ensure that the person was acting appropriately in the community if they were released. And some people were released on what's called their own recognizance, what we call OR for short. And that would be they would be released without a monetary bail.
And just trusted that they would they would come back to court.
Yes, that's correct. If, for example, they didn't have anything that might indicate to a judge that they would, you know, not show up or would be a problem if mm-hmm. they were released. So that did occur.
Okay. So then in the old system, Jerry, you were saying prosecutors are there, but defense attorneys are not, in the old system, were not often present. Is that accurate?
They would be. We would mm-hmm. have some who might be available at that hearing. What we're seeing right now is there's more presence.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that every defendant has representation at those hearings, but we are seeing definitely some more presence there.
Okay. So old system, arrested, judge has X amount of information, judge makes the decision about release and bail. New system, how is that different now? Is there an extra step in there, or?
Yes, as Jerry referenced, now the decision-making is different. The whole statute that set out what happens with respect to bail was just repealed, and they started over from scratch and instituted this whole new policy in the law. And one of the primary things that changed is this pretrial services office under Ms. Fox would do an assessment of the individual, a risk assessment, as she mentioned, to determine their likelihood of failing to appear for the next court date and their likelihood of a new criminal arrest if they were released. And that information is collected via this tool that I'm sure we'll talk about. And then a number, an actual number, is transferred to the court and to the lawyers who are there. And the judge makes the release decision based on that number under the statute.
So does the judge still have the same options that they had before? So you talked about bail before, you had a release on their own recognizance. Those options are all still there for the judge?
Yes, mostly. And under the statute, in some cases, the judge must do certain things. So the way the statute works is that with a certain score and with a certain current charge, here's what the decision making looks like. And in some of those quadrants, if you think of it on a table or a chart, the judge does not have discretion and must release the person back into the community for certain things.
Can you give an example of when a judge must release a person?
Yes, if the current charge is a misdemeanor, that is not certain things. So the statute does exclude what I believe the legislature would consider the more violent things or the more the things that are more of a threat to the community. But theft or a drug misdemeanor charge. And if the person receives a low or moderate risk score when the pretrial enforcement division applies the tool and comes up with the report, then those are what we are calling mandatory OR releases. That is, the judge shall release the person on their own recognizance. So that is the release decision. The judge still does retain the option to impose conditions, and conditions can be along a big spectrum, and we can go into that too.
Okay. So it seems like from this just kind of brief discussion, the major change is now the judge has this new piece of information. Is that the major change? That the risk assessment the new thing?
That's a good way to look at it. Yes.
Okay.
In the past, the judge made the decision with input from the attorneys who might be there and with reference to the charging document and the police report. At that point, of course, the court file is very thin, but there is a charging document. And based on that and the person's record and any other factors that might be brought up. For example, that wouldn't be in their record, their employment history, their ties to the community, any substance abuse issues that could be identified. All that would factor into the judge's decision, A, whether to release them on their own recognizance or instead have money bail, and then B, what conditions might be appropriate that the person needs to adhere to. So the score now is brand new. It's more information, and it absolutely drives that release decision.
Okay. So why was this new tool developed? What's the reasoning behind having this new assessment and bit of information?
Yeah, so many systems are moving to this kind of a model, and there's a variety of reasons for that. One of the reasons is because we have the ability now to collect data in ways that we've never had available to us in the criminal justice models. So we can tell, when we look at historical releases in our state, we can run data about how those individuals performed. And so people in Alaska who have been arrested of a charge have always had bail in our state. That's always been available to people. Now, some people may have made bail, right? And typically we think of bail as a money insurance that they put down and say, here's my money, and it's supposed to somehow guarantee I'll come back. So we can look at those releases and see how people have actually performed. And that's how we developed our assessment tool, based on traditionally, if people don't come back, what are the things that are sort of indicators as to why they didn't return or why they do return? Mm-hmm. So we use that information to then help us understand how that might apply to a particular defendant. Now, it doesn't say this defendant for sure will mm-hmm. or will not return. What it says is this defendant belongs to a group that has an 84% likelihood, for example, of returning for their court appearance in the case of a low-risk case, for example.
Okay. So I guess I have two questions coming from that. One, there was a lot of reporting a couple years ago that was looking at these risk assessment tools and saying that there's problems to them. There's racial biases built in, and they're automatically assuming more negative outcomes for people of certain ethnic groups. How do you make sure that that's not going to happen here?
There are a couple of ways that we need to ensure that we don't then what's called perpetuate a bias through a system like this. So one of the ways we do that is when we develop the tool, we actually controlled for things like how gender or race might impact the performance of the score. So we've looked at that specifically, and the researchers who do this work are able to do that with the math that underlines all of this work. So those issues were controlled for so that hopefully we don't perpetuate bias in our system because of the tool. Now then, what we've got to do in the future is to revalidate that and to make sure that indeed we are not seeing disparities between race or gender as a result of how the tool actually performs.
Okay. So why did we go to the effort to change the statutes and create this tool? Like, what's the logic and reasoning behind this change, Nancy?
Sure. Well, it began with, first of all, this change is a piece of SB 91. A lot of people are familiar with that bill. It was, it became effective in July of 2016, but it actually had three what I consider to be phases. And that means that it had three different effective dates for the groups of changes in that bill. So many people are familiar with phase one, which changed sentences for some crimes. Mm-hmm. And that occurred back in July of 2016. And then a second phase of SB 91 came into effect in January of last year, January of 17. And mm-hmm. those were mostly changes to probation and parole. And now this is the third phase, as I like to call it, of SB 91, effective just January 1st, so 10 days or so ago. And it was all part of an overall effort for the state to assess whether it was spending its criminal justice dollars wisely and whether it could improve public safety and impacts of crime on the community by doing something somewhat differently. And so the legislature set up this commission of experts, and they are heads of the criminal justice agencies and other governor appointees and others, who were tasked by the legislature with studying the entire criminal justice system from the beginning to the end to see what could be done better. And they were driven by the fact that the Department of Corrections data showed that about 66% or two-thirds of people who are released from jail commit another crime, that is, recidivate is the word used, within a very short time period. People did not think that that was a very positive outcome and suspected that the state could do better with some different practices, rules, and statutes. Again, the legislature then asked the commission to figure out what changes might be appropriate to improve that outcome, and the commission made all the changes that some of which became part of SB 91, some the legislature did not adopt, and SB 91 had changes that the commission had not recommended. Mm-hmm. And that's a long-winded way of getting around to this pretrial aspect. It's, as Ms. Fox mentioned, common in other states to do something different pretrial. And what drove the commission was some data that they uncovered showing that in our prisons, about at that time when they were looking at it, 27% of the prison population were people that were pretrial. That is, they had been charged, but they had not had their case disposed, no trial yet. Okay. So under the federal and state constitution, those people, of course, are innocent. They have not yet been proven guilty. And people wondered if keeping 27% of the prison population that were pretrial was an appropriate thing to do. And mm-hmm. maybe there could be a better identification of who really should be in prison pretrial and who could be doing better out in the community. So data like that drove these changes.
So I understand that it would impact the number of people and the cost of keeping people in prison before they go to trial. How does that relate to recidivism?
There were some data and studies that the commission referred to that showed that time spent in jail, really, I believe some of the data showed that as little as 24 hours spent in a jail led people to increased criminality in many situations. So that incarcerating people pre-trial, and sometimes it was just days, sometimes it could be much longer, depending on what kind of case it was. Even that, it would lead to that individual coming out of that situation in a worse place in terms of their criminality than perhaps they were when they went in.
Do we know why?
No, I would speculate why,
okay,
but
Well, so from a practitioner's chair, there's a couple of things that we see. So one of the scenarios we see is, for example, someone who has a $250 financial bail. And so if it takes a person 3 weeks to come up with that $250, which we see, what have they lost in that 3 weeks, right, to come up with $250? So in most instances, when we've seen that, what we've got is a defendant who's eligible to be out. The court has already said, we're okay with you going out. You got to come up with $250. And if it takes 3 weeks, what we've just now done is, through that model, is destabilized a person even further. So now you may have lost your job. You may be getting evicted. You're behind on other financial issues. So what are people? More desperate. Right? People who were already eligible to get out. But now we have pretrial officers in place. So what this means is a judge who may have been on the fence saying, do I release this person? Do I not release this person? Now has another option. They know, okay, they scored low risk. That's good. Meaning, again, that they'll probably come back and they probably won't
commit.
Meaning
they'll probably come back to court.
For court, correct. Okay. They'll probably come back to court and they won't commit. Thank you for clarifying that. I see what I said, right? They'll mm-hmm. probably come back to court for their hearings, mm-hmm. and they probably won't be arrested on a new criminal arrest. And I have a pretrial officer who can help monitor conditions of release, which we've never had in place in our state before. And this is, a huge resource for the court. And also, it's important to note, the court has been requesting something different in pretrial for many years. I found judicial recommendations from the Judicial Council from nearly 40 years ago saying we need to look at pretrial. We need to look at these things. So while it came about as part of Senate Bill 91, there have been gaps identified in this phase in our system for more than 40 years.
All right. And for those of you just tuning in, we're listening to Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about changes in the criminal justice system and the establishment of a new pretrial system and how that impacts both people going who are charged with crimes and the entire community. If you'd like to join the conversation here in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422. Statewide, we're 1-800-478-TALK. That's 1-800-478-8255. We're also taking emails, talk@alaskapublic.org. So you kind of started touching into this whole supervision idea. What exactly do pretrial officers do? Is it like folks have to go check in like they're on parole or probation, or are they out in the community and are they just like saying follow the rules, or is there more to it?
There's definitely more to it. So supervision can look different depending upon what we know about a particular case. So we make recommendations to the court about some conditions we think that the court should consider. Now, the court can then order whatever conditions they think are appropriate. And we're going to learn as we go through this process. So my team makes recommendations, and what we find is those are not helpful to the court, perhaps, as we move forward. And so as we learn about, you know, what the court is adopting and the way that they want to think through these cases, then, of course, we'll help the court by providing more clear recommendations, perhaps.
Okay.
But right now, the courts are making their decisions, and we're offering recommendations for what supervision conditions should be considered.
Well, can you give me an example of what some officers have done in the past?
Absolutely, yeah, and what we're seeing right now, even. So one condition that we're seeing is perhaps some drug testing. If we know that someone has substance abuse as an underlying component of an offense, or it's the direct result of the offense that they're there for now, our units can do drug testing. So that's one option that's now available to the court.
And is it just testing, or can you also help connect individuals to resources?
I think that's a really important point of where we'd like to make sure that we're offering support to defendants. It's challenging in this phase because defendants are presumed innocent until or unless proven guilty by a court of law. And so what they admit to, obviously, could affect the way that their trial plays out or what they say to incriminate themselves. So there's definitely some constitutional concerns about how we interact with defendants. And so what we're doing is we're working closely with defense attorneys as we begin to identify these things. So, for example, we had a defendant come in the other day who is experiencing severe problems with methamphetamine addiction, and he would not stop talking. That's what he wanted to talk about, and he wanted help with it, even though our officers are saying, okay, realize that, you know, you are under supervision here and you do have rights. But we are happy to try to connect you, and we're happy to get your defense attorney involved. And let's see if we can get you in treatment if that's really what you're here to do.
All right. And we're going to go ahead and take our first call from the audience. Don from Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, this is Don. Am I on the air?
You are. You are. Welcome to the program.
Okay. The speaker here brought up a point a little while ago about having a hearing, you know, when the person's arrested, taken to a magistrate court, whatever, and having a hearing to determine probable cause. I have a problem with that. It seems to me there's something, I'm not sure which amendment it is, might be the 14th. It seems to me that there's something in there that says probable cause determination is supposed to be made before a warrant is issued. And if that's the case, then something is being turned around in the procedures. And I'd like to have you elaborate a little bit on that, if you would, because I know some people that have been incarcerated and out on parole, probation, and the procedures for arresting somebody or putting them back in a slammer, and as you mentioned, even within the first 24 hours of maybe concerned about losing their home or not being able to pay their rent, their bills, or lose their car, whatever. I know of cases where a car has been parked downtown for 15 minutes and it got towed because it was in a lot or the wrong place or something. And downtown parking, of course, near the courthouse is very difficult. we don't need to get into that right now.
Let's not get into that. Let me toss your question Nancy's way. So basically, you had a question about the whole process of determining probable cause. And Nancy.
I could try it. Others can certainly answer this question better than I can. For example, the police department. But to get a search warrant ahead of time, an officer does have to provide a sworn affidavit showing probable cause that something is needed. Mm-hmm. And a magistrate judge does have to assess that affidavit and determine whether a search warrant is warranted. Okay. But also, police officers can arrest people with probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And that's provided for in our statutes, of course, and is probably true around the country. Mm-hmm. And then when the police officer fills out a police report or a charging document and the person, and let's say the officer does arrest the individual and brings them to a jail, within 24 hours, the judge has to ensure that in the judge's view, there was indeed probable cause for the arrest as well. So the judge reviews the information, the police report of what he or she observed that led to the arrest, and confirms whether, yes, indeed, that was okay to do, or no, there was no probable cause, and therefore this was not a valid arrest. And that occurs at arraignment as well as at arraignment. People are advised of all their rights and watch a video of their rights, and then, again, the bail is discussed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And Don, thank you for your call. For other people who have questions about how this process works and how this process is changing, give us a call at 1-800-478-8255 or 550-8422 if you're here in Anchorage. So we've talked a little bit about supervision and that the supervision officers can help connect people to resources. When I envision this, because I'm based here in Anchorage, I envision, you know, officers in Anchorage and people being based out of here. What about in more rural areas? Can people receive pretrial services and go back to their homes in small communities?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously we have unique challenges in our state, and we also have limited funding. The reality is I'd love to have a pretrial enforcement officer in every community. That's not going to happen. So we have to partner. We have to build effective partnerships. Our statute has always allowed for a law enforcement officer to arrest someone on a condition of release violation. So that has remained in place as well. And what that means is we partner ahead of time and we let law enforcement know we've got someone who is on pretrial release in your community. So we have officers stationed throughout the state that we can then send out to those communities to do some contacts. We also have some technology available now that will allow some defendants in very rural locations to report via an app. Yep, there is an app for that.
Wait.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can now do some facial recognition things that are available in the technology. Defendants can literally report through their phone and say, yes, I'm checking in. So we're reserving that kind of technology for our more remote areas so that at least we have some regular connection with some of those folks. And then mm-hmm. we also make visits out to those communities as well. So this is where I think the community really gets better public safety. Mm-hmm. We have officers that are going to homes, knocking on doors, and making sure that if someone, for example, has a no alcohol condition, mm-hmm. that they don't come and answer the door with a beer in their hand. And if they do, they'll be going to jail.
Okay. We are going to go ahead and take a quick break. You're listening to Talk of Alaska, and we're discussing the new pretrial services.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
All right. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today, we're discussing how the criminal justice system is changing for individuals who have been charged with a crime, but who have not yet gone to trial. And Nancy is the general counsel for the court system. Nancy, we've talked a lot before about conditions of release and how those are changing. And one misconception is that judges can no longer require bail. Is that true?
That is not true. There were a few things I saw and read in the media saying that this system does away with money bail, but that is not the case. There are certain circumstances, as I alluded to before, where a judge must release somebody on their own recognizance, meaning cannot impose a money bail, because the consequences of imposing money bail is at least some of those people with a money bail simply don't have the funds and can't release themselves by posting that money. So this aspect of SB 91 does include certain circumstances where the judge must release the person with no money bail. In many other situations, the law requires the judge to presume that the person should be released on their own recognizance. But if the prosecutor can reach a burden of clear and convincing evidence that this person ought to have a money bail imposed, then the court may impose it. So the prosecutor then has to show that there are reasons, and the judge has to be, you know, reach this level of clear and convincing evidence that money bail can be imposed, but then the judge can impose it. And for certain more severe crimes, including crimes against a person, so what a lot of people consider violent crimes, and the higher level felonies, domestic violence, sexual offenses, et cetera, there's no presumption. It's kind of done similar to the way it has been, where if the judge believes that money bail is appropriate, then the judge can impose that without the higher level of evidence needed. So those are the different release decisions that the judges make.
Okay. And there's still conditions with release. Like, can judges say, all right, you're being released, you have to have supervision?
Yes, exactly. And that is the change. That's the fundamental change with this. So kind of two what I consider to be linchpins of the law are that this risk assessment tool drives the do I release the person on their own recognizance or not based on their score. And then secondly, there are additional options for conditions that the judge may order if he or she determines that the person either must be released on their own recognizance under the statute or that the higher level was not reached and the person is released because of the presumption in the law. And when the judge releases the person, they fill out a form with what we call the CORs, conditions of release. And one of those now will be to pretrial enforcement division supervision. Now, there are many other conditions that have always been in place, as Ms. Fox alluded to, maybe a no drinking while you're out if the judge has reason to believe that alcohol was a factor in the charge. There are things like you must stay away from a certain area, geographic area, if perhaps there was that's where the victim is, or there's something about the area that the judge believes, you know, is not good for the defendant to go there even during this pretrial phase. And there are things like you can't leave Alaska, you shall obey all laws, you must show up for your court appearances, you must stay in contact with your attorney. You know, don't associate with certain persons if the judge wants to write, when you're with this person, I tend to think that negative things might happen, and or maybe driving conditions, et cetera. So there, those conditions were always in place. And now the change is that you can be ordered to supervision. And this supervision, as Ms. Fox said, can be okay. And it will include drug testing, substance abuse testing. It can be an electronic monitor. When the judge feels like that's warranted, and those monitors can determine whether the person has been drinking. There's another monitor, and Jerry will be better at this than I am, that has GPS capabilities and can ensure that the person stays out of certain exclusion zones. So it's better enforcement of that condition of don't go someplace.
And so does that end up being really beneficial for victims as well, Jerry?
It can be. So these are also the kinds of things that there is never a guarantee, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, individuals do what they do. And so as a community, we have to be mindful and we all have to recognize that, sadly and unfortunately, we do have defendants who behave extremely poorly in this situation. But the risk tool helps us get a better sense for how we might make a more safe decision. So that's one piece that we have in place. And now we have proactive monitoring. So one example that we've had just in the first week is a case where a defendant was ordered to not go to a particular residence. And that day, that's exactly where we found him. So we immediately dealt with that situation and got the court involved and defense involved and prosecutors involved so that we could work through it. So what it actually ended up being was a situation where the victim was at another location and they were trying to get their property switched around so that the accused could go to another location. So we worked through those things, but technically he was in violation and it had to be dealt with. So we were contacting the victim right away. We had the mm-hmm. victim on the phone. We knew where the victim was. We knew what their situation was and their level of comfort. Mm-hmm. So that was great. It wasn't an electronic monitoring device in that case that told us. It was our officers knocking on a door.
And knowing that that person was there.
Yep, exactly.
So then, because the person violated their conditions of release, does that mean they automatically went back to jail?
In most cases, that's exactly what that will mean. Okay. In this particular case, what we had was a transition happening where they were trying to relocate their property. So we actually have a mandatory arrest in that situation. Okay. So that was the intention, take the guy back to jail. But when we got the prosecutor on the phone, it was clear that what we had really is two people that were trying to get their property rearranged. And so with everybody involved, we all agreed that we could negotiate that process. And the reason we could is that we had officers there to help everyone settle this out. And our victim also knew who we were now and had contact information for our officers. So there was everybody knew. We're watching, we're monitoring, we're involved, and all the players had an opportunity to get this thing settled out. So in the past, we haven't had that, mm-hmm. right? We have victims who have been displaced in the middle of the night, for example, and they're all trying to get things sorted out the following morning. So is this necessarily the job of a pretrial officer? I don't know that that's our statutory obligation. I think it's our moral obligation to try to help people settle things out after all of this. But when we find a clear violation, we're obligated to arrest, and that's what we'll do.
And with SB 54, does that change this at all?
SB 54, the primary change that was involved with pretrial was that violations of conditions of release are a new criminal offense. And that has historically been the case in our state. We had a year where that was not the case, about a year. Maybe Nancy can help me out with that as well. But then now it's back. So as of, I don't know the signing date of that, but violations of conditions of release are now a new charge again.
And so that's violations of conditions of release, like while you're awaiting trial.
That's okay. Correct.
Okay. Do you have questions about how this whole new system is working? Give us a call at 550-8422, 1-800-478-8255. We're talking about how pretrial services are changing and the whole process of being charged is changing. I'd like to invite Kristen from Anchor Point onto the program. Kristen, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much. I was just kind of wondering, when the judge is making these assessments, and they're being given assessments by these monitors, I was wondering if membership or connections with organized crime families and gangs in the state has any bearing, because somebody might be a low-level member and doing just low-level nonviolent crimes like just stealing cars, mm-hmm. Breaking and entering, taking things out of people's yards, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And yet at the time when they go in, they are presented as, well, they're low income, this, that, and the other thing. But they know that they're doing this for a gang, and that if they're released back out on the street with bail or low bail, they're just going to keep doing what they're doing until they're caught again or they show up for their trial, or even if they do show up for their trial, because that's always problematic with a gang member.
Okay, so Nancy, how are social connections factored into making these decisions?
The direct answer is that with respect to the tool and the score that is prepared by the pretrial enforcement division and then provided to the judge as well as to the lawyers in the room, the question of whether there's gang affiliation is not an exact question asked that plays into that score. But that is not something that's completely ignored. That is, although the score drives the decision whether the person must be released or not, other factors, including possible gang affiliation, as I mentioned earlier, employment history of the individual, community ties, can be brought up and brought to the judge's attention so that if there is something that seems like it would increase the person's chance for criminality should they be released, the judge can impose more severe conditions, up to and including electronic monitoring. So it is a factor that the judge can consider with respect to the conditions that are imposed.
Still just the judge's decision then on that. In the end, everything with the monitoring and the decision-making, it still falls on the judge to say, yes, I can apply this. No, I'm not going to apply this.
That's generally true. As I mentioned, the statute does require certain actions of the judges. So in some situations, the judge must release the person into the community. And yes, they can impose any conditions, which are up to them. Even if, for example, in the former world and under the former law, that judge would have imposed a high enough bail to detain the person, they can't do that now in those situations, but they can impose conditions that they didn't have available before.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you for your call. And we have an email with a fairly specific question. If someone was arrested in December of 2017 and is out on bail with third-party house arrest, are they going to be monitored by your team?
They could be. So what we are not doing is assessing any case with a court date that falls before 2018. The court case number, if it's before 2018, that individual would not be assessed. What we saw the other day, and perhaps Nancy wouldn't agree with this happening, but this is one example we saw. We had a defense attorney who asked for a bail review for one of their defendants. And in that bail review, the judge ordered the defendant to transfer over to pretrial enforcement supervision. And so we took over the supervision of that case of an individual who had been out in some other circumstance. So I would argue that they're not being assessed, but we already have seen some cases where a judge is transferring supervision.
And so defense attorneys can request it.
They can. They can request these hearings and those kinds of adjustments to the supervision. And I would argue where that particularly would make sense is if we've got something that's concerning to the court. I don't know that a defense attorney would think that life is going to be better under pretrial enforcement supervision. But we also have instances where, a third-party custodian is a substantial responsibility for a family. And so my belief would be that families would be saying, we cannot continue this. And as long as the individual has been doing okay, perhaps supervision with our unit would be something that the court would want to consider, or an electronic monitoring device, perhaps.
Okay.
I think I would just add that may be arguable under the wording of the statute. Mm-hmm. And apparently it happened according to Ms. Fox, and that's fine. But I would say that these provisions of SB 91 apply quite clearly in the law to offenses that were committed on or after January 1st, so that if an offense was committed before that, one could read the law as saying this new bail statute does not apply and the new pretrial enforcement division supervision does not apply. And I just say that because I suspect there may be arguments about that, and I'm not certain how different judges would come down or if it will be fully resolved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to go back to the phone lines. We have Mary on the line from Bethel. Mary, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to make some comments concerning pre-trial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people are jailed, I think that they should stay in jail until their trial is over, because when they have to leave to try to get their $250, they, in the process, are drinking and getting into other criminal activities like child abuse, rape, and stealing and whatnot, and taking people out of jail on pre-trial does not reduce the readmissions to jail. And I think that it would be better if they stayed in jail until their trial is over. That would save a lot of money and a lot of work for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my feeling, because having been a victim of a number of things that relate to this kind of activity, I don't go with the so-called the new pre-trial condition. Because if mm-hmm. people are released and they have someone watching them, they still don't do anything. And then when they go on trial, the lawyers are making excuses that they were not in their right mind. And so they get released to do more criminal activity.
So, Miss Mary, I'm going to let Nancy kind of explain a little bit about how this works, because what we're talking about are people who have been charged with something but have not been proven guilty. So, Nancy, would you?
I'll try to address that a little bit, and I certainly understand the sentiment. I think there mm-hmm. are quite a number of people who do agree with the caller that when somebody is charged with a crime, there are strong indications that the person is a criminal, even though that has not been judicially determined yet. And some of those people will, if released into the community, as the caller said, commit more crimes. We don't want that to happen. And what we're faced with is a constitution that says that people are innocent until proven guilty. And until somebody's proven guilty, you have to have strong reasons for restraining their liberty. And what the hope is, and this was the legislature's hope in enacting these laws, is that with additional tools, we will better identify those who would commit additional crimes if they were released. But those who are not likely to, or who are a low risk for recommitting an arrestable offense, maybe it is better to let them back into the community, not increase their criminality by holding them in jail, and let them try to be a prosperous member of the community because, for example, there isn't indication that they're violent or would recommit. And I understand really the sentiment that it's difficult to do that. I mean, judges are trained to do that and do it often, but identifying exactly who will do better released and who really ought to be detained with a money bail or something like that is what we're working at. And the more information, the better.
And
yeah, so I often call that the crystal ball. I don't know a criminal justice professional out there who would not want a better tool, a more precise tool, a way of predicting the future. We every one of us would like more, better, absolutely 100%. We'd all want it. We don't have it. And we also have to balance that with people's constitutional rights. So the assessment tool gives us a way of really sifting through that population a little bit more carefully, for mm-hmm. one. And then it hopefully also allows us to use our resources more appropriately. So low risk individuals who score on this tool in a low-risk category means that they don't need as much of our attention. Mm-hmm. But a moderate or a higher-risk defendant who does secure release needs more attention. So, for example, we had a situation, I believe it was yesterday, of a $100,000 bond, which means the individual has to come up with $10,000 to get out. They got out. They're out. But now they're being supervised by a pretrial enforcement officer. So I think it's helpful when the community understands that individuals make their money bail right now. They make bond. And what we need is opportunities for them to not only be supported, right, if they need support systems in place, but also that they have accountability and enforcement that's making sure that the public is safe. And that's our obligation, is to protect public safety. And there's no mistake about that in our criminal justice system.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Mary. So we keep talking about the risk assessment. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can lay out exactly what that tool really explains and does.
Yeah, so the risk assessment tool, again, looks at two factors, your likelihood of fail to appear, and that would be fail to appear for a court hearing, and the other one is the likelihood of a new criminal arrest. And arrest does not mean conviction, it means that you're arrested. So if an individual is released from custody following their arrest and they're awaiting their trial, are they going to succeed in that phase, or are they going to fail? And a fail is you return to custody or you fail to appear for your court hearing. That's how we define a pretrial failure. So the other word that is confusing to people in our state is when we hear the word pretrial, because we typically think of pretrial meaning you're held in jail in our state, because we don't really use the words jail as much here. Mm-hmm. Like we have Matsu pretrial. So people think Matsu pretrial means you're in jail. Pretrial is a legal status. It means that you are unsentenced. You are pending trial. Custody, a secure setting, means you're an inmate awaiting your trial. But now we have community pretrial supervision as well. So that's the addition. When people hear pretrial, it's a legal status. You could be held in custody. You could also be on community supervision.
Okay. So this risk assessment tool is just, it's a set of questions. Mm-hmm. Like, it's objective questions. Like, what are you asking to actually determine someone's risk for not coming back?
Yeah. So for failure to appear, we're looking at, have you ever failed to appear? And if you have ever failed to appear, how often? I hear this quote, you know, things like, the previous behavior is the best predictor of the future. Well, in this case, we see that failure to appears result in failure to appears. Another interesting thing in our failure to appear score is whether or not a person is convicted of a property offense, which is, we were surprised that that ended up there. So I would assume that that has to do with, are you stealing people's stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so we don't really know why that turned out to be important, but it turned out to be important. And so you get more score, a higher score, if you have property offenses in your background. Huh. For a new criminal arrest, which I agreed was like, okay, well, that's interesting that showed up in our data in Alaska. A new criminal arrest really includes things like, how often have you been arrested for a misdemeanor? How often have you been arrested for felonies? How often have you been placed on some other form of supervision? So it's those kinds of things. There are six questions that we ask for the failure to appear score and six questions that we ask for the new criminal arrest score. And actually, it's not an ask. It's all based on criminal records. So we don't go to the defendant and say, have you ever been arrested, right? We don't ask the defendant. We go to the criminal history databases and court records to get all of our information.
And so if someone doesn't have a court record or criminal history, then
then the score is low. So so this is where it's very important that we have the judicial body involved in these, especially for higher risk cases. Mm-hmm. And that's why our Alaska statute also looks at the crime as part of the decision. So score is one part. Mm-hmm. It's one part. But also where you fall in terms of the crime classification, which Nancy sort of mentioned, this decision matrix. Mm-hmm. And so the higher of the severity of a crime, and I'm saying that just kind of generally to capture this idea, but the higher the degree of offense or the seriousness of offense, the more strict the conditions the court can consider.
Okay. And we have, someone has written in, This is Tyler from Ketchikan. Concerning the pretrial assessments, I'm concerned that discrimination will continue to be an issue, as several studies have shown that discrimination and bias can happen without any conscious knowledge of this thought process. How are we planning on taking concrete steps to ensure that it's not an issue? I'd like to see a plan to conduct statistical analysis at regular intervals to ensure that bias, even unconscious, does not have an effect on how these decisions are made. And you talked earlier about a reassessment of this tool. Mm-hmm. Are there any plans in place to make sure that judicial bias unconscious bias isn't impacting judges? Is this a concern?
One of the things with the tool is that it, as I mentioned earlier, just drives the release decision. So the tool, as I'm sure Ms. Fox would explain, is on a more or less a schedule to be revalidated and rechecked against mm-hmm. certain populations at regular intervals. And so, for example, in a year, they will look at what happened, what scores came out of the tools, and try to assess how that might have varied according to gender, mm-hmm. cultural background, race, ethnicity, et cetera, of the defendant, to try to recheck it and ensure that there wasn't a racial bias involved. And that was done in the development of the tool also, as I understand it. In terms of judicial bias, we have, as I say, sometimes there's no discretion. So if you have to do X, the judge does X under, you know, what the legislature told them the law is. To the extent that there are discretionary decisions about what conditions to impose, the court is always trying to ensure that there aren't racial biases. And indeed, in all of its decision-making across the whole, not just criminal justice system, but across all of its decisions. And the judges do get training in this. There are checks. The court has a diversity and other committees and subcommittees, in fact, a number of them, who try to address the issue and ensure that we minimize it, if not eliminate it, as much as possible.
Okay. So I would argue that the tool can help with that as well. And so I appreciate when I hear the word statistics, right, coming mm-hmm. from one of our callers, because that's what this tool gives us now. We are measuring outcomes to get better outcomes. And so the idea that we would ignore data in any modern field where we have all of this information now available mm-hmm. to us, it would just be wholly irresponsible and immoral to ignore data that can help us get better. And so this is data. It's mm-hmm. based on statistics, and we need to use more of it in the future. That's the whole idea of evidence-based decision making. That's why we're even using this term in criminal justice now.
And that is why we're about to wrap up, but that's why these pretrial decision or services were created, because of data from other states.
Exactly.
All right. You've been listening to Talk of Alaska, talking about criminal justice reform. My guests today were Jerry Fox from the Department of Corrections, the head of the new Pretrial Services Division, and Nancy Mead, who's general counsel for the Alaska court system. Thank you to everyone who called and wrote in. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.